Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer in Tel Aviv. The situation in Israel grows more challenging by the day. The country has been mired in war for 7.5 months now. Thousands of people from the north and south are displaced from their homes because of the fighting. Others living near the Gaza and northern borders are trying to live their lives in nearly active war zones, living from siren to siren. There are over 100 Israeli hostages still held in Gaza. Several returned in coffins this week, and we don't know how many of them are still alive. As the conflict wears on with no end in sight, tension between Israel and its allies abroad continues to grow, and protests continue around the world over rising Palestinian casualties and the untenable humanitarian situation there. In short, it's a time when we all have a lot of questions and need an informed voice of reason more than ever. That's why it's a good thing this week that we're having another special episode of a podcast in which subscribers to Haaretz submit their questions to one of our leading journalists. Last month, we sat down with correspondent Shireen Falah Saab, and this week we are here in the studio with none other than Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz. Aluf has been leading the paper here for the past 13 years. He has a long and storied journalism career, including stints as Haaretz's military and diplomatic correspondent. Aluf, how are you holding up these days?
Look, we got used to the, some kind of war routine. The beginning was extremely difficult for many reasons. We had people from our staff were both attacked on October 7th, or their families in the villages around Gaza were attacked, their friends kidnapped, family members kidnapped or killed. It was a very tough getting by and understanding what was going on. And we had several people called to a very long reserve duty from the staff. But, you know, over time, it became an unfortunate reality that everybody in Israel has to cope with, and so are we.
I want to get to the subscriber questions quickly, but we can't ignore the big news of the day, the helicopter crash that killed the president of Iran. Do you see this at all affecting the conflict between Israel and what are essentially Iranian proxies? And my other question is, do you see speculation or any kind of possibility that Israel was at all connected to this disaster, even though clearly it looked like a weather-related and conditions-related situation? Is anybody even suggesting that Israel had something to do with it?
I didn't see any authoritative source suggesting that. Nor have I seen any Iranian blame game, blaming Israel for the crash, for the death of the president. And the foreign minister was also a key official in the Iranian regime, especially in negotiating all kinds of deals with other countries around the region. First of all, the conflict now is not just between Israel and Iranian proxies or other groups and organizations supported by Iran. It's also with Iran itself. Israel killed the Iranian general in Damascus, and in return, Iran launched hundreds of missiles and drones towards Israel last month. So this is a direct conflict as can be. That doesn't mean that Israel is involved in the crash. And politically, diplomatically, I don't think that this event would change much, because President Raisi was not an important decision maker in Iran. The decisions in Iran are taken by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And both the president and the foreign minister were his lieutenants, but they will be replaced. And I don't think they have made any difference in the direction of Iranian policy. So we're not going to see beyond, you know, expressions of sorrow and condolences. I don't think that any of the Iranian proxies and Iranian-supported militias and so on are going to change their behavior.
Let's start with the subscriber questions, and we'll begin with the ones that relate directly to the war being waged in Gaza. Here's our first question.
My name is Giora, and I live in Los Angeles, California. My question is as follows. Since Netanyahu is firm in his insistence on attacking Rafah, and since Biden is firm in his insistence that such an attack will cross his red line, what will stop the world from declaring Israel a pariah state and condemning it in the UN Security Council, demanding an immediate ceasefire, and seeing the U.S. either abstaining or voting for such a resolution.
Beyond the Security Council issue, Alouf, if you can talk a little bit about what you see happening exactly in Rafah at the moment. We also received questions from subscribers about war tactics. Are we really fighting there? Are we not? Is the international pressure, particularly from Biden, as Giora mentioned, having an effect on what's happening on the ground?
Israel has been under a lot of internal pressure from parts of the government and from Prime Minister Netanyahu himself to invade Rafah and to go after the remaining Hamas forces there. And Netanyahu repeatedly portrayed it as the key to winning the war, and we cannot just leave these Hamas battalions behind and with Hamas leadership there, etc. The Americans and the rest of the international community were firmly opposed to an attack in the same way that the IDF operated in northern Gaza, in a somewhat different way and smaller extent in Khan Yunis in the past month, mainly because there were about 1 million refugees from the other parts of Gaza crowded in Rafah who have nowhere really to go because many of their former homes, community services, schools, hospitals, shops, whatever, have been destroyed by the IDF. So the American demand was not to avoid operating in Rafah altogether, but to find ways to evacuate the civilian population there out of harm's way. So Israel launched a smaller and slower attack on Rafah. But to the bigger question that Giora posed, look, if we go back to Israel's history and its relationship with the United States, we realize that whenever there was an issue that Israel viewed as vital to its existence, to its national security, to its policy, and found the U.S. opposing it. And it goes back to even to the declaration of Israeli independence in 1948, to Israel's refusal to take back at least some of the Palestinian refugees from the War of Independence. The declaration of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel against the international community, which still, by and large, refuses to deploy their embassies there. The U.S. changed it only under Trump. Going back to the establishment of the Dimona nuclear reactor and the Israeli nuclear program, all the way to settlement building in the West Bank, in Gaza in the past, in East Jerusalem, widely and strongly opposed by the international community and the United States, and Israel carried it out. And Rafah is no exception. And the reason for that is that the U.S. is very hesitant not to use its veto power in the Security Council vis-a-vis Israel, let alone when it's an election year, an election campaign. And although we hear more about the criticism of Israel in the Democratic Party, there are still strong bases of support for Israel. I would not like to see the president waving the veto and throwing Israel into the arms of the Security Council and rolling back the snowball of calling for a ceasefire and maybe sanctions down the road, etc.
So you see the worst possible scenario is possibly abstention, or you don't even see that?
Well, we saw that in a very, very mild resolution that was passed several months ago, calling for a ceasefire after the Ramadan, which didn't happen. We have to wait and see. The veto is not set in concrete. And clearly, whatever decisions the Israeli government is taking, and Netanyahu and the Israeli military, etc., the way the American veto power, which is essential to Israeli freedom of action vis-a-vis Gaza or Lebanon or wherever, and number two, the American arms supplies. There is no substitute to American arms supplies to Israel. So that's always on the mind of the decision makers. But as I said, Israel has its way of standing up to the United States and getting away with it.
The next question is about a topic that is very much on subscribers' minds, several questions about it, and that's the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the amount of humanitarian assistance getting in. So here's our question from Norman.
Hello, my name is Norman from Toronto. My question is, why is the U.S. building a temporary port in Gaza? Why is it needed? There's a very good port nearby in Ashdod. As a follow-up, why is Israel now preparing a humanitarian area for the population of Rafah? Could they not have secured a humanitarian area right at the beginning of the war? And if they'd have done that, they would have avoided being castigated for not providing humanitarian assistance. Thank you very much.
So, Alouf, what's happening on the humanitarian front, and do you have an answer for Norman?
My answer for Norman would be that there is a very big debate in Israel about the humanitarian aid or even the passage of humanitarian products, food and medicine, etc., into Gaza, with the Israeli right wing strongly opposing it and arguing that you should not supply your enemies, Hamas in that case. And we see, in recent week, we see right-wing hooligans attacking Palestinian trucks that are supposedly on their way to Gaza with different kinds of foods and other merchandise, and you know, burning the trucks, beating up the drivers in order to block this humanitarian aid from coming through. Israel for a long time opposed the usage of Ashdod port and the Erez crossing in northern Gaza to pass goods and supplies into the northern Gaza mostly, which is a no man's land with most infrastructure damaged or destroyed, and the risk of famine that the UN warned about was mostly concentrated in northern Gaza. Under American pressure, Israel agreed to open the gate to some extent. But beyond that, the U.S., after trying to parachute supplies, which wasn't so successful, they decided to build a pier in Gaza and just bring in supplies with ships to cut through the red tape of Israeli bureaucracy and the Israeli protest and Israeli police not really trying to block the protest because they're under Minister Ben-Gvir, who's the leader of the far right, etc., etc. So it's a big issue in Israel, and it's mostly a political issue.
Here's our next question, which I think is the proverbial $64,000 question when it comes to the Gaza conflict. It comes from a subscriber named David.
Hello, my name is David. I'm from Scotland. My question is there a long-term plan regarding what will be done with Gaza? If there is one, what is it? And what level of scrutiny and debate has there been surrounding this plan to test and examine it?
Alouf?
Well, I think that the only plan that I can think of is a long-term Israeli occupation of Gaza. That from the beginning, Prime Minister Netanyahu, while refusing to hold any cabinet level or other discussion about different scenarios for the post-war reality in Gaza, from the very early days of the war, he was saying time and again that Israel would have to bear the security responsibility in Gaza for the foreseeable future. And when we, and this is euphemism for long-term occupation. How do we know? Because this is what's happening in the West Bank. In the West Bank, after several years of Oslo, in which the Palestinian Authority had the security responsibility in Area A, in the main Palestinian town, after 2002 and the Second Intifada and the Israeli reoccupation of the West Bank and these towns, Israel took over that responsibility. So we see the idea of occupation where you have some local authorities taking care of basic services and social services and so on. But the Israeli military is deployed and the Israeli military has freedom of action. And in the case of the West Bank, there is an armed Palestinian police. In Gaza, there are no volunteers to do that. Israel has indicated its refusal to bring back the Palestinian Authority from the West Bank to Gaza. And as Netanyahu just said a couple of days ago, no to Hamastan, no to Fatahstan, which means a long-term Israeli occupation. The far right in Israel and the far-right parties and large parts of the of Likud, of Prime Minister Netanyahu's party, support the re-establishment of Jewish settlements in Gaza, both in the area that was the settlement area before the disengagement of 2005, but also in northern Gaza, in areas that were destroyed, neighborhoods and towns and villages that were destroyed during the war and now populate them with Israelis. And the way Israel conducted the war so far indicates that this is a possibility. Clearly, there is a strong international opposition to that, and this would be depicted internationally as ethnic cleansing of Gaza.
And presumably majority domestic opposition to it, no?
Yes, but look, the majority of domestic opposition was also there vis-a-vis the West Bank settlements. And they exist with hundreds of thousands of Israelis living there. So the question is not if you ask people, do you support it? But would you go out of your way to prevent it? So Netanyahu at first said something against the settlements in Gaza, but I think it should be judged over time. But the basic plan of which is now more in the open, of Israeli occupation with military occupation, with building the facilities for that, as happened in Gaza before Oslo, it's now on the table. And we just heard the Defense Minister Gallant warning against it. But Gallant's opposition was not to the idea of Israeli control in Gaza, but the price of that occupation in terms of deployment and the budgets and so on. But this is secondary opposition, I would call it. It's not primary opposition to the idea of reversing the disengagement, taking Gaza back under Israeli control. And again, for the far right, they see an opportunity to drive out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Gaza to the Sinai and maybe to other Arab or Western countries in the same way that President Bashar al-Assad drove out millions of Syrians, of Sunni Syrians, out of Syria to strengthen the Alawite minorities hold over the country during the civil war. And the far right in Israel is basically demanding that.
Well, that's a natural transition from military to politics, obviously related. So here's our next question from a subscriber named Karen.
Hi, I am Karen from Germany, who, according to your knowledge and analysis, could be the political leader capable of leading Israel out of the present quagmire.
Alouf, this question is very relevant to the moment because the man who is viewed as the most likely alternative to Netanyahu is standing at a political crossroads, Benny Gantz. So if in answering the question, you can tell us a bit about the political test that Gantz is facing right now, how he's handling it and his prospects for the future, and maybe give us your takes on alternative leadership, including the new man throwing in his hat from the left, Yair Golan, and someone who's challenging Netanyahu and Likud, not necessarily politically, but at least ideologically to a certain extent, or tactically, Yoav Gallant.
The common thing to all those people you mentioned, including Yair Golan, is that there is
I didn't even mention Yair Lapid. Wow. Also, Yair Lapid
the opposition leader.
Yeah, the opposition leader.
The main thing that we have to bear in mind is that Netanyahu lost a lot of his popularity after October 7, and rightly so. But he has been able to hold on to his coalition, and there is no sign of any imminent collapse of this coalition or any cracks within it that might bring him down. And personally, he took zero responsibility to the disaster of October 7. He put all the blame on the military and intelligence chiefs who failed to warn, failed to act, failed to wake him up that crucial night before the attack, and so on. But the main thing we have to bear in mind here is that this unpopular government, by all the public opinion polls for 7 months now, lagging behind, trailing the opposition in the polls. But at the same time, it's leading a very popular policy. There is very strong support in the Israeli Jewish society to continuing the war until the defeat of Hamas and hopefully also of Hezbollah, the return of Israelis to live along the borders in the south and the north, and a more quiet future. With Israeli Arab society, is different. From the beginning, the mainstream Arab public opinion in Israel has called for immediate ceasefire and prisoner exchange. But given the political circumstances in this parliament, the Arab parties have very little clout or very little influence, unlike the previous one, where they had a foot in the change government, in the impasse when Netanyahu was out of office for a year and a half. So Gantz does not present any opposition to Netanyahu's policy. The only main difference is that he demands a discussion of the day after, but just like Netanyahu, he says no to the Palestinian Authority and fantasizes about some other forces. And the same is true about Lapid. Lapid was willing to say Palestinian Authority in Gaza at the beginning of the war, but then quickly stopped doing that. And even Yair Golan, the presumed future leader of the left, is not saying that. And none of them is saying, well, it's not just about post-war Gaza. The two-state solution that used to be mainstream in Israel 20, 25 years ago, 15 years ago, even Netanyahu adopted the idea, no Jewish political leader in Israel is willing to say two-state solution, which means that the Israeli political scene is totally out of sync with the global conversation about the conflict and about the post-war future. But as long as there is no alternative to Netanyahu's policy, it's just a matter of style. Gantz is not blamed for corruption like Netanyahu, standing trial for 3 corruption cases. Gantz is more likely to listen, to be attentive to American ideas, to the American government, rather than using a conflict with America to build his right-wing base like Netanyahu. In another very contentious issue in Israel, the draft or lack thereof of ultra-Orthodox youngsters into the military, which now is both because of legal reasons and also because the army needs more soldiers, became a hot topic in Israel. But here too, Netanyahu is totally tied to his alliance with the ultra-Orthodox parties, and Gantz hoping to get some inroads into that alliance in the future is also the former chief of staff who fought the soldier for all his life. Even he refuses to say that these ultra-Orthodox kids should be drafted. And just say, we need a plan to do this, to do that. So I don't see the real alternative here in terms of policy. It's more in terms of style, which matters in politics. But so far, it's not enough to drive strong wedges inside Netanyahu's coalition. And Defense Minister Gallant, even before the war, there are two Likud politicians who positioned themselves as contenders for Netanyahu's legacy. Justice Minister Yariv Levin from the ideological far right, and Defense Minister Gallant was more attentive to the old Israeli mainstream militaristic point of view. They're still there.
But it seems like they are more likely to prioritize, I guess, for example, a good relationship with the United States over the pressure coming from the extreme right than Netanyahu would be.
That depends on the political situation. Look, all prime ministers in Israel, even when they were anti-American and far-right before taking office, and the prime example, obviously, was Arik Sharon, and to some extent, Naftali Bennett, when they take office, they realize that, you know, you can be anti-American in opposition, but not when you're in power. And the same is true with Netanyahu. Netanyahu knows how far he can go with fighting the United States publicly. With Gantz, with Lapid, this would not be the case with Gallant. With Levin has no real experience or standing in foreign security policy, so we don't really know what he stands for beyond being very ideologically in the right. But he was the only one who said that to get information about the war, he used to watch Al Jazeera, which is now banned in Israel, right, by his own government. Yeah. But he was their biggest fan in Israel.
That was a question about Israeli leadership. Here's a question about the future leadership for the Palestinians. And it mentions a name that many of our subscribers mentioned in their questions about the Palestinian side.
Hi, I'm Julie from San Antonio. Please talk about why there have been no Palestinian elections for years and years. Who might be Palestinian future leaders who might move things forward? like Marwan Barghouti?
Alouf, what do you think?
Palestinian elections were held the last time in 2006, and then Hamas won the elections for the Legislative Council. Israel refused to recognize the outcome, and that began the events that led eventually to, a year later, to the Hamas takeover in Gaza and the Israeli siege of Gaza ever since. Since then, there were two main obstacles. One is that in order to carry out the election, the Palestinian elections in East Jerusalem, which is part of Israel, you need an Israeli acquiescence, and Israel needs to allow the deployment of polling stations in East Jerusalem, which Israel has refused to do ever since. And the other issue was reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. And that was the one thing that all Israeli governments since then, and especially Netanyahu, stood up against and prevented. And Netanyahu's idea was always that you should export the civil war to the other side, have Fatah and Hamas fight each other, and Israel preserve some sort of unity, at least vis-a-vis the Palestinians, while any peace process or any meaningful move towards Palestinian independence or more autonomy or more territory and so on would entail Israeli rift within Israel, as happened after Oslo, leading to the Rabin assassination, and then before the Gaza disengagement. And so that consideration prevented Palestinian elections from taking place. And obviously President Abbas enjoys to be a dictator like other leaders in Arab states. He does not really want to let go of his position. He's not getting young. He's a heavy smoker, but still going, still traveling. And I remember discussions about his legacy, and the day after Mahmoud Abbas for years, he's still there. Marwan Barghouti is a more popular Palestinian leader after Abbas. And to some extent, I think even Hamas leadership respects him. I'm not the biggest expert on Palestinian politics, but it appears that he has more credibility than others. But, you know, he's been in Israeli prison for 22 years for five murder cases from the Second Intifada. And Israel has never indicated any willingness to release him. So, once again, that depends on Israel. And there are many questions in the air. Will Gaza and the West Bank reunite? How will Hamas, after the war, transform, remain as power in Gaza, remain as a military power, remain as calling the some of the shots, at least, in Palestine, in the Palestinian national movement? There are so many questions and so many unknowns here. But clearly, the Israeli involvement is crucial.
I can't finish talking about politics without asking the question that constantly comes up whenever we solicit anything from subscribers for a podcast, on a webinar. The overwhelming majority of questions are about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And the phenomenon preceded this war but has continued and intensified since it's begun. Haaretz readers simply cannot believe that a leader who has failed on so many levels, as well as being on criminal trial, is still in power. So here is one question that represents many, with the added twist of asking whether the readers, the people overseas themselves, have any ability to influence the situation.
Hi, I'm Mike from Chicago. Many of us Jews in the United States are deeply invested in Israel. By all accounts, Prime Minister Netanyahu has not only been a major obstacle to any efforts for peace, but some say he's prolonging the war for his own purposes. What can we in the United States do to help get him replaced? Thank you.
Most people would say move to Israel, right?
Well, one way is to move to Israel and vote against him in the election when they will take place, and the official date now is late 2026. So we have
there's time to arrange and plan and pack. Yeah,
exactly. Look, the truth is very simple. Netanyahu enjoys a parliamentary majority of 64 out of 120, and in Israeli terms, it's a landslide. And as long as he enjoys that parliamentary majority, it's a parliamentary system, so he could stay in power. And so far he withstood both his criminal trial, but also large waves of protests that culminated before the war against his proposed judicial coup and his overall effort of this government to turn Israel into more of a theocratic autocracy, where it would be even more difficult to replace the ruling powers. And I don't see that changing. External pressure so far was good for Netanyahu, because that solidifies him with his base. And his base of support, regardless of what happened in the country, including the massacre of October 7th and the major failure leading there, Netanyahu's policy of appeasement toward Hamas that blew up in everybody's faces, so far his own support base puts all the blame on the protesters, on the opposition, and would just like to see Netanyahu as their leader forever and ever.
So we can't even tell Mike, oh, lobby your congressman and President Biden in the presidential elections to put more pressure on Netanyahu, because you're saying that just could boomerang and help him more.
Pressure on Netanyahu to change his policy might cause him political trouble if he goes against the will of his political partner from the far right. But so far, it's been ineffective, including, well, one congressman, Senator Schumer. I don't know if he's got letters from his voters, but he did stand up and speak against Netanyahu, which Netanyahu only used to show how much he's standing up to the American left and so on and so forth. You have to bear in mind that the Israeli public, both Netanyahu supporters and others, the media diet that they get in Israel is mostly a repetition of the horrors of October 7th. Very little reporting. We in Haaretz are the exception, but most Hebrew media in Israel ignores what's happening in Gaza. It shows Gaza only through the lenses of the IDF cameras rather than describing it from the Palestinian point of view. And the mainstream thinking about anti-Israel protests around the world is just a bunch of anti-Semites and who are just out there to destroy Israel and get rid of it and kill all the Jews in Israel. There's no real discussion in Israel about what's happening in Gaza, about the humanitarian issues, about the killings of many Palestinian innocents, about the damage and destruction done in Gaza. It's all seen through the lens of they had it coming and they deserve this punishment, and Israel should fight the war to its end regardless.
That feeds right into our next question, which is related to asking for help taking the pulse of the Israeli public.
Hi. This is Martin from Bucks County in Pennsylvania. My question is, to what extent do Israelis understand that the current government's policies toward the Palestinians are alienating a large swath of the American Jewish community? And even if they do understand, do they care?
They understand and they care, but I believe, again, it's very difficult to formalize, but I think the mainstream thinking is that these people, if they want to support, they should make Aliyah and come to Israel, or to see some of them at least as diehard progressives who are anti-Israel and trying to please some progressive wokish ideas, and Israel is the victim of that. And I think this is what Netanyahu and the right wing have been telling Israeli Jews for 15 years, and it stuck, because in Israel the liberal Israeli Jewish voice has been diminished. So it's very difficult to sell the American Jewish liberal voice to Israelis these days.
One more question about Israeli public opinion, and this one circles back to the hostages and to the war in what our subscriber calls a thought experiment.
Hi, this is Deborah in New York City. Could you address the following thought experiment regarding the link in the Israeli public's mind between returning the hostages and continuing the war? If Hamas unilaterally released all the hostages, which I know is pure fantasy, how would this affect the Israeli public's support for continuing the war in Gaza? Thank you.
Okay, I can just speculate. I believe it would be seen, and this is how even those people who called to do a lot to bring back the hostages would say, okay, bring them back and then fight Hamas to the end. Now, without the hostages, Hamas is more would be more vulnerable to Israeli attacks. Because if Yahya Sinwar is not surrounded with Israeli hostages, it would be easier to bomb him and kill him, which is one of the major goals of the war. And but clearly, it's sheer fantasy. Hamas knows that too. They're not going to release all the hostages, and let alone in one move. And they demand a total ceasefire and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, which Israel refuses, and the release of many Palestinian terrorists in Israeli prisons to them would be a victory of the resistance against Israel. And to Israel, it seems as releasing the next bunch of fighters to replace those killed in Gaza. Just like Sinwar himself was released in the previous exchange in 2011, and see what happened. But since there's no real meeting of minds towards a hostage return deal, the real debate about it has not really begun in Israel. But once again, the far right opposes any deal, and in their mind, the hostages are, they should have to pay the price. You know, they were at the wrong place at the wrong time, and you see a lot of violence, both verbal but also physical, against families of hostages that are protesting against the government and calling the government to do anything and everything to bring back their loved ones to Israel. And we see more and more hostility by the BBS, by the right-wing camp against these people. This was unthinkable because in the past, in Israel, the families of hostages and prisoners of war were saints. Nobody, they were untouchable.
I have to ask, do you think it would be any different if the hostages had been taken in religious West Bank right-wing settlements?
I'm not sure. I don't think that it's just a matter of many of the hostages being from kibbutzim that identified with the left, or people who dance at the rave. That was basically on Friday night. It was not religious people. It was very secular people. I'm not sure. I think that there is a stronger position in the right wing to release of Palestinian prisoners and to give anything to the Palestinians.
Aluf, the last subscriber question I'm going to give you is what I'm considering the cry of the troubled progressive Jew in America who has the most existential of questions when it comes to Israel.
Hi, I'm Candy. I'm a progressive New Yorker, suddenly alienated from my progressive friends, including many Jews who are now attacking Israel's very right to existence. I'm personally appalled by both Hamas and Netanyahu and supportive of two states. So how do I defend the formation of the State of Israel against those who say it was land stolen from the Palestinians? And how do I defend against attacks of apartheid and colonialism? Thanks.
There's a challenge for you, Aluf.
Well, you know, I'm not the Minister of Public Diplomacy or Asbara. And you should tell them what you believe in. Many Israeli progressives were struck by the opposition to Israel in the global, mostly American, but also European progressive camps when the war began. And they were shocked by, but before that they believed in the same ideals. And now these people were telling them, no, you're Israelis, we don't want you to be part of us. And that led many previous left-wingers in Israel to what we call sobering up. Now we understand the real threat, and we understand that we're really alone, and we have no friends around the world, etc., etc. Look, Israel contributed to that criticism for decades by its occupation and settlements in the West Bank. And only last year, the government, the new government, the existing government of Israel, Article 1 in its guidelines, you know, the official policy document of that government, says that Jews and only Jews have any rights in the entire space of Eretz Israel. That includes the West Bank and Gaza, which means that the Palestinians not only don't exist, they don't have any rights in that space. And that's a very hard sell, not only to progressives.
Alouf, before we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts on, I guess, maybe the direction of the subscriber questions, which I tried to make sure, you know, reflected the many, many questions that came in, and the role of Haaretz in trying to inform the wider world of what it feels like from here and how things look from inside Israel, knowing through these questions and through a lot of the feedback that we get at Haaretz in English, how it's looking to the rest of the world?
You know, we're trying to do our job. We're trying to be more critical and to give a wider range of views and news than the majority of Israeli media. Sometimes we criticize for not doing enough, not showing enough footage from Gaza, and sometimes. But I must say that in this conflict, unlike previous rounds of fighting between Israel and Hamas, like 10 years ago and before that, we got very little criticism from within Israel for reporting about Gaza. I can't say from Gaza because we cannot get any of our reporters there to the Palestinian side, but we can call people, we can interview people. We interviewed people who left Gaza. We interviewed people like internal refugees within Gaza. We're in touch with a wide range of people there. We got very little criticism this time for reporting that, unlike the past, which means that there is a group within Israel who's willing to listen and to face what's happening on the other side as well.
Alouf, you have held up very admirably and answered all the questions well. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Thanks again to Haaretz editor-in-chief Alouf Ben and to my producer and editor Nara Malkin. Our next special episode for Subscribers Questions is coming up this summer as election season heats up in the United States. That episode will be with Washington, D.C. correspondent Ben Samuels. If you want to be able to ask him a question, all you have to do is subscribe to Haaretz.com if you haven't already. And while you're subscribing, make sure you're also subscribed to this podcast on your podcast platform of choice. And if you are so inclined, give us a 5-star review as well. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, Shalom from Tel Aviv.